from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. President Obama called for a new beginning between the United States and Cuba after he was elected in 2008, but former Cuban diplomat Ambassador Carlos Alzugaray says that was just rhetoric and the United States is still locked in a Cold War mentality that hinders any progress towards reconciliation. The ambassador joins us in studio to discuss what he thinks it will take to improve cooperation between the two nations, and we'll also discuss with him the present state of the island nation under what is being touted as a new era of political and economic leadership under Fidel Castro's brother Raul. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of our forum program. Former Cuban diplomat Ambassador Carlos Alzugaray is with us in studio for this hour. He's a former professor at the Center for Hemispheric and United States Studies at the University of Havana and served as Cuban ambassador to the European Union, and we welcome him. Bienvenidos.
Thank you, Michael. Very happy to be here.
Glad to have you here. And we're going to talk about U.S.-Cuban relations this hour. We're also going to talk about, such as they are, also going to talk about changing nature of what's going on in Cuba. And there have been a lot of changes, and a lot of them certainly very positive from the ambassador's state of point of view. But let's talk first about normalization of relations, which has been so difficult. And I know that you have been talking very forthrightly about back in 2009, President Obama said there would be a new chapter. No new chapter yet.
Huh? No new chapter yet. Not yet.
And yet, in many respects, even where many Americans are concerned outside of Florida, perhaps, this has been a failed policy. This is not a good policy. A lot of Americans would like to have the advantage of going to Cuba. We've got thousands of Canadians going there and so forth, UK, people from the UK. Let's hope if we do allow full visiting from Americans, it doesn't turn into Disneyland. All those old cars don't go out of the way. Mm-hmm. But what do you see as the biggest impediment at this point of just sitting down and talking, for example?
Well, I think there is the big impediment, which is I think it's a kind of ideological gridlock in which Cuba is seen by many people in the government and outside the government as a Cold War enemy. And when you analyze all the measures that the United States has taken with Cuba, they date back to the Cold War. Breaking up of diplomatic relations, non-recognition of the Cuban government as a legitimate government, which, as a matter of fact, the rest of the world recognizes, Canada, Spain, everyone. That's 1961. The embargo dates from 1962. Cuba in the terrorist list dates from 1982. The Cuban Adjustment Act, which is a special condition for Cubans to emigrate to the United States, dates from 1966. So when you look at the legal framework of how the U.S. deals with Cuba, it's all from the Cold War, and the Cold War is over.
The Cold War is over. It ended supposedly with glasnost and perestroika, though you wouldn't necessarily know it under Putin today. But let me go back to the argument here that Cuba declared a terrorist-supporting state, and a terrorist state had a lot to do with Angola, but it also had a lot to do with and continues to have to do with support for the FARC and rebels in Colombia and also for Basque rebels, does it not?
Well, that's very debatable. Even if you look at the State Department report, it recognizes that Cuba is not engaged in any kind of terrorist activities against the United States. And Cuba was put in the list in 1982 because of an incident that happened in Colombia, not because of Angola. Angola never figured in the problems. And Angola was negotiated in 1988. At the end of 1988, an agreement was signed between Cuba, South Africa, Angola, with the United States participating, and finished that. But the argument from 1982 was that Cuba was aiding the Colombian revolutionary movements. But now Cuba is accepted by the Colombian government as a bona fide mediator in the peace negotiations that are taking place in Havana. So how could you argue that Cuba is supporting a terrorist organization which is negotiating with the Colombian government? It's kind of funny. It's kind of paradoxical because actually, after the United States spends billions of dollars in Plan Colombia to help the Colombian government bring peace, Cuba is actually helping bring that peace with diplomatic methods.
So where do we start building bridges, or how do we start building bridges? I guess it just comes down to talking, doesn't it, initially?
Yeah, it comes down to talking, and that's exactly the point. Take the case, for example, of Alan Gross, the American who is in prison in Cuba.
The Which Cuban has become a major cause, by the way, here in the United States. Yeah,
it is, but there are other. There are four Cubans now in jail in the United States for doing something similar, but not exactly the same.
I thought it was five, actually.
Yeah. Well, one of them is already in Cuba. Yeah. Rene is already in Cuba. But you have one here, Gerardo, who is in prison in California, probably one of the most incredible cases because this guy has been convicted to two life sentences.
So some are saying defenders of Gross and critics of the Cuban administration, although it's changed, we got another brother now, and we'll get to that, but are saying that Alan Gross is being held essentially as a pawn to try to get the other Cubans released that you just alluded to. That this is all an attempt to have a deal.
Well, Gross broke Cuban law. I mean, he came into Cuba not recognizing that he was working for the U.S. government and doing things that Cuban law doesn't permit. Foreigners who enter illegally or under false auspices to do something. So he's not a pawn. He confessed to what he was doing, and he was actually working for the U.S. government. If someone come into the U.S. and work for a foreign government and didn't declare it, start doing things that are prohibited by law, that person will be arrested and will be convicted. So it's exactly the same.
He's been ill, though. He's been suffering.
He's been ill. Yeah. I must say, for humanitarian reasons, I think he should be released. And I think the Cuban government wants him released. But the Cuban government wants some kind of reciprocity. Now, there is these four guys who actually are anti-terrorist agents. They didn't come to the United States to overthrow the American government, which was the case with Gross. Let me remind you, the program under which Gross came to Cuba is defined by U.S. law, the Helms-Burton Act, as bringing about a regime change in Cuba. Now, these guys were not doing that. What they were trying to find out, what the terrorists were up to, and remember, Cuba suffered acts of terrorism in 1997. That's about the time when they were arrested. These guys from El Salvador came to Cuba hired by a guy who is free in Miami, Luis Posada Carriles, and some people in Miami adore Luis Posada Carriles. He's a terrorist. He has been called the Latin American Osama bin Laden. So these guys were doing exactly what the U.S. government does when it wants to protect the U.S. people. They send anti-terrorist agents to infiltrate terrorist networks. That's what they were doing.
No defense of Gross, but he sounded terribly naive. I mean, he was pretty much given this communications equipment, took it, and it sounded like he was really just feeling he was doing something for his government that was a nice deed or something those lines.
Or I tend to think like you, but the other interpretation might be he was arrogant. He thought he could get away with anything because the Cuban security services were very bad.
Well, let's talk more about what maybe in addition to the Cold War or in addition to seeing Cuba as a terrorist state or supporting terrorists, like even though they now have relations with Colombia, there were also, and again, most of these people are in Florida today, though in exile from Cuba. They felt their property was taken from them. American corporations felt their property was taken. And there is also the ongoing close relationship that Cuba had with Venezuela, and particularly Hugo Chavez. Had a mind blank there for a moment. These seem to me also to be part of at least the whole edifice upon which we have these troubling relations with Cuba. And well, ongoing troubling relations, yeah?
Well, the question you talk about Venezuela is a very important question for Cuba. Does the United States has the right to tell Cuba with whom they should have good relations? Take the case of China. China has an excellent relationship with Venezuela. And yet President Obama met the president of China last week in the United States. So why should Cuba be different? Cuba has an old relationship with Venezuela. It's a relationship that goes back to the 19th century. The first country that Fidel Castro visited after the revolution was Caracas. So why shouldn't Cuba be close to Venezuela, plus the fact that, of course, the Cuban government sympathizes with the Venezuelan government.
Well, what's you mentioned China. It's always seemed to me and so many others who have observed the ongoing sanctions and attitude that the United States administration even presently has under President Obama, that it's been paradoxical, to put it mildly, that China, which is also violating human rights, is put in a different category than Cuba, which is condemned for its violation of human rights, and also Cuba condemned for not having democracy when China and the United States have close relations. These are just, you know, the kind of hypocrisies, I suppose, of what we call diplomacy or what we call statecraft.
How many other countries don't have democracy and the United States has excellent relations with them? In the Middle East?
Well, I think you can count them even well beyond the Middle East throughout the world. That's just the point. There are real grievances, though, of people in Florida. I mean, our own politics are too tied to those real grievances.
Okay. I can understand them, but let's face it. First, the issue of the nationalization of properties in Cuba was a tit for tat thing in which the United States started. The United States started by suspending the sugar quota and Cuba responding by nationalizing. Some nationalizations in Cuba were predictable because since the 1940s, the Cuban Constitution had said, the Cuban Constitution approved in 1940, stated very clearly that there had to be an agrarian reform and that the redistribution of the land was an important issue for Cubans. The Cuban government only did that. And, of course, immediately the reaction of the Cuban, let's say, oligarchy, landowners, was to get out of the way. They mostly went left for Florida thinking that the United States would get rid of Fidel Castro. They made that mistake. They didn't stay to protect what they was their own. And then they collaborated with the United States. Remember, the United States organized the Bay of Pigs as early as March 1960, only a year and something after the beginning of the revolution, when there were still some moderates in the government, and they invaded Cuba. That was illegal. The people who permitted themselves be hired by the CIA, trained by the CIA, and thrown in the beaches in Cuba to attack their country, what are they?
So who's being hurt most, in your judgment, by this ongoing attempt to keep Cuba isolated, the United States or Cuba?
The Cuban people. The Cuban people suffer from the embargo, suffer from this abnormal relationship.
When I was in Cuba, I talked to a lot of private citizens, and some of them were rather open with me. Some of them were afraid of being open with me, I'll be very frank with you, and, you know, felt that they could be in trouble if they said things that were revelatory of anything. But I would hear over and over again this lament about the boycott and so forth, but a lot of the blame seem to go more on the government. I mean, you go to Cuba and you have this strange economic system where a neurologist makes less money than a waiter or than, you know, someone who is carrying suitcases, because that's the system. It's an economic system that a lot of people feel very handcuffed by and very, frankly, compromised by.
That's true. The Cuban economic system is a Frankenstein. I always argue that, because Dr. Frankenstein didn't want to build a monster. It turned out to be a monster, but he put parts of different bodies that he thought were fine. That didn't work. And that's, I think, part of the blame for where Cuba is right now is, of course, the wrong policies that the government followed during 50 years.
So things
more
are
less
gonna,
than 50 years.
Things are going to change tremendously because you have the brother of Castro now in charge?
Well, I think it's not only because of that. I mean, there was this debate in the 60s in Cuba about what would be the right socialist economic policy. And the Cuban government, little by little, adopted policies that really didn't... They obviously redistributed the wealth, but they weren't wealth-creating policies. That was wrong. But remember, you have to take into account two other factors. The American embargo, which hit Cuba very hard in the 1960s. Then Cuba could more or less get out of that with the help of the Soviet Union. But then Cuba had to suffer the end of the Soviet Union. The end of the Soviet Union meant the elimination of 70% of Cuba's foreign trade and 20% of the GDP. So Cuba has had these three factors that obviously have an impact in the economy. The embargo, the fall of the Soviet Union. You can argue it was their mistake. It was the Cuban government mistake to put all its eggs in the basket of relation with the Soviet Union. Plus, you had this patchwork of different economic policies that have not a strategic sense and that underestimated the market. The main mistake, if I would say what was the main mistake of Cuban economic policies during all these years, was underestimating the power of the market, thinking, like Che Guevara thought, that socialism could not be built with capitalist instruments and that you had to create a new man. That hasn't happened, obviously.
That's the Frankenstein.
That's the Frankenstein.
Yeah, well, you have to look to China again, and I guess you are looking to China. Ambassador Carlos Salsugaray is with us in studio, former Cuban ambassador to the EU, who previously served 35 years in the Cuban Foreign Service and is now contributing editor of Temas, which is a Cuban social science journal and which is having debates regularly in Cuba. I mean, things are opening up, according to you. Things are getting more democratized and public voices are... But the poverty, when I was there, was still so wretched. I must tell you, I was thinking about Jose Marti, who said, you know, one needs prosperity in order to be good.
And I often quote that.
Yeah, well,
I often quote that.
You can't resist the quote, right?
I mean,
because I saw that poverty firsthand, not only in Havana, but in Camagüey. And, you know, it's wretched. That's the only word to describe it.
Well, it seems that the government has heard that because the first thing that the most important government leader after Raúl Castro, Mr. Miguel Díaz-Canel, says whenever he's asked, he says, we are trying to construct a prosperous and sustainable society. I don't think anyone would challenge that or would disagree with that.
But you also want to broaden the markets under Raúl Castro, clearly. And there's been talk about this as being, somebody called it a handcuff capitalism, said that, you know, the markets may be broadening, but they're highly regulated. And they're, for the most part, outlets for, well, skilled small family businesses, let's say.
Well, some of the businesses are growing. And I think one of the laws that is coming on is the cooperative law, which would open the way for more private enterprise. Of course, I am not a neoliberal. I don't think that you should privatize everything. I think, for example, public services should be owned by society and administrated and managed by the government. Of course, I would argue that the government has to be accountable of what they are doing with the goods that they manage in the name of the people, which is a basic concept of socialism that sometimes is eliminated. But I think this is the direction we are going. The direction we are going is expanding the non-state sector. That's the politically correct word in Cuba for the private sector. And then trying to make the state sector as efficient and as accountable as possible.
What is the present view, would you say, especially since you've had some public debates about, the regime, really? I mean, there's been a lot accomplished under Fidel Castro, education and healthcare, particularly with gender equity and racial mixing, in the best sense of the word. On the other hand, you know, he's looked upon here in the United States to a great extent as a tyrant, as an autocrat, as someone who's punished political enemies relentlessly. What is the assessment of Fidel now in terms of the Cuban people and their openness about viewing him?
Well, I can give you my opinion. I think he achieved two very important things. You mentioned one. The other that has to be mentioned is the independence of Cuba. Cuba was a country that was very much under the control of the United States. And not for the benefit of everyone. That was the main problem. The Cuban oligarchy benefited from that relationship with the United States, but the rest of the country was in shambles. I am reading a book now. I don't remember the author has been published in the United States. I would recommend it. It's called Gangsterismo. It's about the mafia in Cuba and the level of corruption of the Cuban political system before the revolution.
I have to read his Havana Noir, and you get the whole picture of Meyer Lansky and
yes, Havana Nocturne.
Corruption that was there, yeah.
Yeah, so that is important, the fact that Cuba became independent, that at the same time, Cuba started to play a very important role in world politics. In some places, for example, you mentioned Angola. You go to Africa. I serve as a diplomat in Africa. As a matter of fact, in Addis Abeba, the capital of where the OAU is, the organization. And all African diplomats and all the Africans were very happy with the role of Cuba in Africa. It helped finish colonialism, and it helped end apartheid. So they're happy with what Cuba did in Africa. And this is a motive of pride for most Cubans.
And the view of Fidel now, though, I mean, in Cuba?
So one would accept that he did that well, but that he was a very poor economist and that he didn't. I think this is something that is like the undertext in what Raul is saying. Raul is insisting again and again in creating institutions and creating democratic institutions. He has said it. He has said, we have to democratize, we have to create institutions. That basically is the rule of the law. The law over the persons. The persons don't have more capacity than what the law establishes. I think that's a very positive phenomenon in Cuba. It's hard for me to criticize Fidel. I am a little bit like Raul said once, Fidel is like our father. You might disagree with your father, but it's very difficult for you to criticize your father outside the family. I am critical in Cuba about the policies.
I'll take your word on that. It's also been to the loss of the United States, though. I mean, not only in terms of visiting Cuba, which is a wonderful island nation and the people are spirited and full of life, I can attest to that, but also oil and gas discovery, adverse to U.S. interests, to pretty much go against that. And now we've got this whole embroilment in Guantanamo. I mean, there have been so many things that suggest if there could be bridges built or if there could be, you know, I'm not necessarily taking an editorial point of view. It just seems logical to me that the United States has suffered, too, by not having better relations or even any relations with Cuba.
I think there are many things on which the issue here is that on many issues, we really cooperate a lot. For example, the Cuban Meteorological Institute and the Miami Hurricane Center cooperate strongly during the hurricane season. They have to. Of course, we would like, I mean, most Cubans would like Guantanamo to be not only the prison camp closed, but also the base returned to us and maybe turn it into a Pan-American health organization institution to help people in the continent, in the hemisphere. But you know what? There is another issue which I think the U.S. government should look at. The leaders, the future leaders of Cuba are mainly, like this guy, Díaz-Canel, who is the vice president, are people born either in the late 50s or the early 60s. To say it in a very short statement, they were born embargoed by the United States. So the United States has to establish some relationship with these people. And the best thing to do is open up, is letting Americans go to Cuba, getting Cuba out of the terrorism list. There was a time when rectors of Cuban universities would come to Cuba, would come to the United States. Why cannot that cannot happen?
Well, let's open this up for discussion on this forum program. What do you think about opening up relations with Cuba again? And why hasn't the Obama administration moved in that direction? He doesn't have to run again. And he said publicly that we should begin a new chapter. You can join us and we invite your phone calls. Our toll-free number is available now. It's 866-733-6786 if you'd like to talk to the ambassador. If you have a question or comment, again, toll-free 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. Or post any questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, or you can also communicate with our Facebook page. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the possibility of improving or even establishing U.S.-Cuban relations with Ambassador Carlos Alzugaray. He is a former Cuban ambassador to the European Union and previously served 35 years in the Cuban Foreign Service. I said to him off the air, he said, well, people tell me I'm optimistic. And I said, yeah, you're a diplomat. What do you expect? Of course you're optimistic. But President Obama had called for a new beginning between the U.S. and Cuba after his election. As the ambassador says, perhaps that was just rhetoric at this point. The United States is still locked in a Cold War mentality, hindering any progress toward reconciliation. And we're talking about what might be well, a better path to improving cooperation between the two nations. We do welcome your involvement in the program. If you have a position on that, or if you simply would like to join the program with questions or comments, you're welcome to do that. Our toll-free number, again, is 866-733-6786, or feel free to email us, forum@kqed.org, or post questions or comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, or you can post questions or comments on our Facebook page. Let me go to our callers right away, and Toon Lin is our first caller. Good morning.
I just wanted to put it out there. I really am not looking for an answer from the ambassador, but maybe the White House, that President Obama saw fit to go to my birth country, Rangoon, Burma, and invited the military junta leader to the White House recently to open up trade relations and diplomatic relations with Burma in the midst of continuing military strikes and massacres against ethnic minorities, the Kachin and Rohingya minorities in Burma. In that context, he saw fit to open up relations. It really befuddled me why there's a double standard here.
Yeah, it's a good point about Burma. Of course, Aung San Suu Kyi came, there was more democratization where she was concerned and more with the government, and President Obama's outlined a much more Pacific-oriented. We did a whole program on that. But this is another good example of a double standard, is it not, with Burma?
Yeah, it's obvious, as we were discussing before. The United States doesn't claim to have a human rights problem which leads to non-recognition, non-normalization of relations with many countries in the world. And there are, of course, many countries in the world that have different... I look at the human rights issue as like a continuum where you have the worst dictatorship. Fortunately, I think those of them have ended. Pinochet in Chile, the Argentinian military junta. And then you have very democratic governments like the Scandinavian countries, like Switzerland, whatever. In the mid... In the middle, there are different stages. And you should look also what is the movement of the country. But I don't think international relations or diplomatic relations should be based on that, except in extreme cases.
I'll bring another caller on, and that's Marcy. Good morning.
Hi. I came to this country as a child, and I've been studying it for 50 years. And here's a conclusion that I've never heard expounded before. I think the embargo was the best thing that ever happened to Fidel Castro. It's the red herring he can blame everything on and has kept him in power for 50 years. Can you imagine if all of a sudden you open up trade and ideas and music and genes? And, he'd lose control. So if you study congressional hearings, you will see whenever there's a Democratic administration, Fidel invariably does something that really upsets the United States. And then the overtures just kind of stall. It's incredible. He is brilliant. And I think he figured it out really early in the game. Blame everything on the embargo, but publicly have a face, and privately, whenever things stall, go dodge that bullet.
That's a fascinating thesis you have there, Marcy. I'd like to hear the ambassador's response. Marcy is a Cuban-American, that Castro was wily enough and cunning enough that he used the United States as his bete noire to his great success.
Well, that's a way of looking at it. Of course, I disagree, but I would like to look at the future, and the future is, and what's happening in Cuba now, is that you don't hear Raul Castro blaming the embargo for anything. He basically told recently a meeting of government leaders, don't get me this idea that this is wrong because of the embargo. We have to work with this. So that's not his position. And on the other hand, I don't think you get a real sense of what's happening in Cuba. I was trying to watch a film in my plane ride from New York to here. And all the films I saw in the program I had seen in Cuban television for free. So we are not that isolated. Cubans, recently I was...
All those of you who are paying for Comcast, take note. Yeah, you can go to Cuba.
Yeah. In Cuba, you can... I remember being in Mexico when Avatar was going to be premiered. And I arrived in Havana on a Saturday, and my wife told me, tonight they're showing Avatar in Cuban television. Let's watch it.
With 3D glasses?
Yes, yeah. With 3D glasses.
But tell me something. I mean, let me think, Marcy, and... you get into, for example, the fact that Cuba, which was once the world's leading producer of sugar, is now importing sugar from Vietnam. I mean, this seems to me to be crazy in some ways.
It's crazy. Obviously, the government made big mistakes in the issue of agricultural economic policy. They're trying to rectify that, and every week there's a new measure by the government trying to bring back sense to this. But I think they will have to do much more than what they are doing up till now.
Here's a listener who writes, on July 22nd of last year, Oswaldo Paya and a young aide, Harold Sapero, died in what the Castro dictatorship termed an accident. The Paya family is asking for an investigation conducted by international experts. Would Carlos Azugaray support the call for an international investigation?
I don't think it's necessary. The main witness was the driver of the car, a Spanish political activist that had gone to Cuba to help Paya. He was tried in a Cuban court. The Spanish government followed the trial. They were satisfied. I don't remember his name. He went back to Spain after the Spanish government negotiated with the Cuban government that he would finish his to serve his time in Spain. And he started to say this. And the reaction of the Spanish foreign minister was, if this guy has something to say, go to the courts and demonstrate it. So I say, go to the courts, wherever courts there are, and demonstrate it. In Cuba, we don't have any doubt that was an accident caused by reckless driving by this guy, who also had a history of reckless driving in Spain before he went to Cuba.
Another question from a listener about Miguel Díaz-Canel, who was named the first vice president and designated yep. as the chosen successor to Raúl Castro. According to Otto Reich in the National Review, and I'm quoting, since his name is not Castro, it is highly unlikely he will ever be president of Cuba. Why is that? Because Cuba is run like any other organized crime family.
Oh, that's very gross to say that. Díaz-Canel has been... elected by the parliament as the first vice president. He most probably will be the guy who would succeed Raúl Castro as president. If the caller has any evidence that there is a Castro on the way, I would be happy to hear it. But between Fidel, Raúl, and Ramón Castro, they have more than 15 children. And none of them is playing a major role in the politics of Cuba right now, except one.
Well, the daughter of
Mariela Castro, who, by the way, what she's doing is supporting gay and lesbian rights and supporting a modification of Cuban laws to adapt to the new reality in a country that was very homophobic. That's one of the great things that has been happening in Cuba. Recently, there was a concert in the Karl Marx Theater attended by thousands of people, which the main interpreters were gay and lesbian actors and interpreters. And who were in the first row? Miguel Díaz-Canel, Mariela Castro, and René González, this fifth spy that was sent back to Cuba, or I should say Cuban anti-terrorist agents, that is now finishing his term in Cuba.
There's also been in Cuba some remarkable changes as far as anti-Semitism. I mean, after the Pope came, there was a great opening up of religion, and Cuba had certainly a lot of anti-Semitism. But then...
You're talking about anti-Semitism or anti-religion?
Well,
because you talk about anti-Semitism.
I'm conflating them in a way, but yeah. But that's because there seems to be a very strong openness within the Cuban community to Jews and no discrimination
that is
really even overt. I remember the leader of the Cuban Jewish community, who was a woman, saying that she met El Jefe, Fidel Castro, and invited him to a Hanukkah celebration. And he said, what is Hanukkah? And she said, it's a celebration of a revolution. He said, I'll be there. And he came. So it's a funny story. Here's David Alameda, who writes, I have long believed that ending the embargo and normalizing relations would bring the Castros down in very short order. I mean, full normalization, offer free travel without visas, exchange ambassadors, invite Fidel and Raul for a state visit, establish naval cooperation in the Straits of Florida. In other words, treat Cuba like any other neighbor. Does Senor Azugaray agree that this would work?
Well, the problem is that my objective or my purpose is not to bring the Castro down. My objective or my purpose is to build a better and more democratic, prosperous, and sustainable Cuba. And I think that will happen with or without relations with the United States. I think the United States is who is losing in this situation, because Cuba is changing. And that's something that everyone can tell you.
More from the National Review, which you know is a fairly conservative, yeah, to put it mildly, journal. But they ask about Cuba's virtual apartheid, whereby Cuban citizens are forbidden to enter a tourist hotel unless accompanied by a foreigner who must show his or her foreign passport to the Castro police. And that experience, they argue, is as humiliating as Cubans to Cubans as racial apartheid was to South African blacks.
I think the National Review should check their facts. That is not the policy of the Cuban government now. I myself have stayed in hotels, and not because I was who I am. Cubans can enter a hotel and any tourist installation, and if they have the money to pay, that's no problem.
Another listener asks, does Carlos Azugaray favor or oppose the repeal of the Cuban Adjustment Act of 1966 in light of the fact that Cubans are now legally permitted to travel? And how does he justify his position?
I think the Cuban Adjustment Act must be repealed, because it was a Cold War policy done to put Cubans in a very special situation in immigration terms in the United States. I don't believe in privileges, so... why should Cubans have a privileged situation as they are immigrants in the United States when Mexicans, Chinese, and Salvadorians don't?
More of your calls, and we go next to you. Phil, good morning.
Good morning. I'm from Miami. I'm not a Cuban. And, you know, the Bay Area, everybody seems to think the reason Cuba is economically backward is because of the U.S. embargo. But the European Union freely trades with Cuba, and you know, the quaint thing about traveling in Cuba is you go there and they've got, you know, 58 Chevys still running on the street. And, you know, economically, I mean, the medical system there is quite advanced, but the rest is not.
Forgive me, Phil. Some of those 58 Chevys have different motors in them, though.
Yeah, they have usually Soviet oil, diesel engines.
But agreed, yeah. So, sorry, I'm not that into it, but it's not exactly like, you know, Fiat is what I'm saying. So economically, you know, Cuba has remained quite backwards, even though there is not a European embargo. So it's not just the United States that's creating the economic disadvantage to Cuba. There's something structurally about the society. And the only thing else I want to kind of leave in is, you know, Jimmy Carter didn't normalize. And, you know, the current administration, I wouldn't say, is, you know, right-wing, and they're not normalizing. So, you know, isn't there more to it than just the U.S. is the big bad guy kicking Cuba? Doesn't Cuba foment anti-American sentiments throughout South America and support arms and, you know, the you know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying, but I think you're raising many issues there. As to the embargo, let me give you an example. If Cuba cannot buy European airplanes, Airbuses, because they have more than 10% American components. So the American embargo affects trade between Cuba and third parties. And of course, there is all this because of Cuba's in the terrorism list. The Treasury Department persecutes any financial operation done by any European bank with Cuba. And as a matter of fact, several European banks have been fined for dealing with Cuba in the most normal manner. On the other issues, okay, there was a time when Cuba supported revolutionary movements in Latin America, but that's gone. Nobody claims that Cuba is supporting any kind of military uprising.
So many and Latin American governments have gone to the left.
Most Latin American governments have gone to the left.
But you could say that baldly now. There is no support for revolutionary movements among the present Cuban administration? Anti-American movements?
Since the 1980s, since the late 1980s.
Phil, do you buy it?
I kind of do, but for some reason they seem not willing to restructure the society. That I think there's a little bit of sentimentality for the revolution and not a lot of forward-looking planning for how to move Cuban society forward.
Well, thank you for the call. I'll tell you, I must say I saw more pictures when I was in Cuba of Che Guevara than I have seen of anybody anywhere, and he wasn't a Cuban.
Well, Che was very popular in Cuba because of the reasons that you can check out in the Motorcycle Diaries or Scorsese's film of Che. He was a guy who really acted like he preached. You might be in disagreement with about what he preached, but he really did it, and he paid with his life, so you have to admire the guy.
He is a martyr, and we'll take another call. Neil, that's you. Hi.
Yeah, picking up from what that man said, the last caller said about Carter's attempt at a detente with Cuba. What happened there? Why did the attempt fail? And what exactly does Raul Castro mean by democratization? How is the human rights situation going to improve in Cuba exactly within the next few years, can you say?
Okay, the situation with Carter was, I mean, Carter really wanted normalization. There were a lot of contacts and things done, but of course, things started to sour. At the end was the Mariel immigration crisis. But what happened basically was that when the Reagan administration took over, they pushed back all the things that had been done during the Carter administration. The second question was about...
What was your second?
Rights in Cuba. Yeah. What does Raul Castro mean when he says that Cuba should democratize more? How is that going to improve the human rights situation in Cuba?
I think, you know, no country can claim to have a perfect human rights situation. We're coming from a situation in which certain restrictions were imposed because of this siege mentality that existed in the 60s. That's changing. The journal that I am the editor of, for example, has every last Thursday of every month a public debate about a public issue. We have discussed internet, the double currency. This last month, the last Thursday, we discussed public opinion and decision making. So isn't that democratization? Isn't that a sense of being more democratic?
Would you discuss political prisoners and human rights violations?
Yes, of course. No doubt
openly.
About it. Openly. If somebody at our discussions brings that subject up, nobody's going to tell them to shut up and not talk anymore.
Let me thank the caller. Listener named Sophia writes, the ambassador did not pick up on Michael Krasny's assertion that racial equality had been achieved under Castro. It's actually not what I said, but let me read the rest of it. She writes, when I visited over a decade ago, there were no top-level people of color representatives in government, no dark-skinned guides, small business people, et cetera. What racial equality are you talking about? I never said racial equality. I just was talking about the fact that there is no real apartheid system. You see blacks mm-hmm. and whites intermingled in ways that you just don't see in many countries. And but she has a point there. I remember in the hotels, for example, a lot of the more menial workers were black. There's no question about that. And as far as blacks higher up in government?
Well, I think that's a fact. I mean, I won't challenge the fact that even though the Cuban government, the Cuban Revolution at the beginning eliminated most of the rules and regulations that created a racial discrimination, another thing is to eliminate racism. Racism is in the minds of people. People have to change. And this is something that, for example, most Cuban academics, politicians, and intellectuals are talking about. There is a movement called Cuban Color inside my organization, the Union of Writers, that calls for the elimination of all racist barriers. There are still racist barriers in Cuba. I don't question that. But for example, Raul Castro has called for an affirmative action kind of program. He has said that whenever there is two candidates for a post, there should be the people who are younger, are women, and are black should be picked over the white older men. And that's happening. For example, the president of the Cuban Book Institute is a very important black woman. And right now in San Francisco, in this area, I think in Berkeley today, is Nancy Morejon, who is probably Cuba's most important black poet. And she is the president of my association. She is the president of the Cuban Writers Association. So it's a mixed thing, but we are conscious of the problem and we are working on it.
And we bring another caller in. Kim, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. I did a research about 3 years ago on essential oils and holistic medicine, and I stumbled across the fact that in Cuba, I don't know if it's still true, that there's like one doctor per a certain amount of people, and they really get to know their patients, and they are more, you know, preventative and they're more holistic. And it just seems like, even though it's not like Western medicine with all the like prescription pills and all this stuff, that it seems that they're, and that Cubans are actually healthier than Americans. And I find it interesting that he mentioned that turning Guantanamo Bay into like a medical center and nobody talks. I mean, it was just like, we always talk about Cuba as being in negative forms, where here's like, it's, I think, proven that in Cuba the medicine and how they go with their citizens is well more advanced than us here in the U.S.
There's no taking away the advances in Cuba in terms of medicine. The only problem is, from any doctor's perspective, they make the same wages as people who are, I don't know, doing whatever kind of work. But also the educational system, it's the best in Latin America from every standard that's been applied.
In general, I think we can be satisfied. Let me point out, Cuba has exported 76,000 medical workers, health workers, to all over the world. This is something that even President Obama, when he's talking about the new beginning, he said that's something we should look at and how does Cuba does it. And we are proud. I mean, Cubans are
proud. A
lot of
them in Venezuela.
A lot of them in Venezuela, but they are in South Africa. Let me tell you something. Last year, I was invited by the Australian government. They wanted my political consistency because they are developing a program by which hundreds of young kids from the Pacific Islands are going to study medicine in Cuba, and Cuba has sent 35 Cuban doctors to help the Pacific Islands deal with their health problems, which is very important because they are small countries, very far away. So this, I was very much satisfied. Look at this. The Australian government, an ally of the United States, working with Cuba to help the Pacific Islands. Isn't that nice? Isn't that how things should look in the future?
Let me read some more emails that are coming in. Roger says, please note that Cuba, with the GDP of a poor third world country plus a crushing embargo imposed by the United States, has built an egalitarian society in which education is guaranteed for everyone through college or grad school, as is lifelong health care. There is no illiteracy in Cuba, and social indicators in many instances exceed those of the U.S. Several years before Hugo Chavez's death, President Chavez was the only the second most popular head of state in Latin America wide polls. Fidel Castro was the first. Free speech can hardly be said to be an issue when everyone who has been to Cuba knows that complaining about the government is a national pastime. All right. Some more voices here from listeners. Jerry writes, the embargo should have ended with the Clinton administration right after the fall of the Soviet Union. That it has been allowed to continue shows something very wrong in our thinking. Mary Lee, what is the real story behind the Cuban Five? Their silhouettes are on decals in the police jeeps throughout Cuba, especially noticeable in Havana. Some billboards about the Cuban Five on one or two buildings in each city. I understand that we still have four of them in prison here and that a court in Atlanta said they should be retried, outside of Miami, but nothing has happened. Couldn't that be a starting point in melting the freeze in our relationship? Must the U.S. really wait until the Castros are gone to begin the process of establishing relations?
Well, I think on the issue of the Five and in the issue of Alan Gross, I think both governments should sit down and try to find a solution, a humanitarian solution to all these cases. The family of Alan Gross should have Alan Gross back. I don't have any problem with that. But I think the case of the Cuban Five, now Four, is important because these guys were not hurting the United States. They were trying to defend Cuba. And that's a very important difference with the Alan Gross case. Whatever you think of Alan Gross, he went to Cuba on a program to destabilize the Cuban government.
I've got another email here from Dan who writes, the ambassador is disingenuous in his description of Alan Gross. Mr. Gross worked for the U.S. Agency for International Development. He was arrested for attempting to bring satellite phones and computers to Cuba's small Jewish community. He was no spy and was arrested because Cuba wanted a pawn to exchange for the Cuban spies held in the United States. Another opinion heard from.
I disagree with that.
I know you do. You've already on record. Let me get a caller from Miami, Florida. Moises, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I have a question regarding reverse migration. Is it possible for an American to either seek citizenship or residency in Cuba? I have Cuban parents, so maybe is there a route via that? I'll take the
off the phone. Yeah, and he doesn't mean the Emilio Gonzalez route, I don't think. But can an American move back to Cuba, literally?
Yeah, they could. They could. Of course, the issue here would be a job. You will have to have a job or something. It's all countries have certain migratory regulations in order for you to really get... You cannot come to the United States to immigrate without some sort of program, government program, or a job. When you have a job, the people who hired you will go through the whole process. So in Cuba, that's also the case. You could probably, and I know many Americans who live in Cuba. I have American friends who live in Cuba who have children in Cuba and who work in Cuba, either for Radio Havana Cuba or whatever. I mean, that can happen. But again, probably the best thing to do is approach the Cuban consular services at the Cuban intersection in Washington and inform yourself of what can be done.
Here's a delicate question for you, Ambassador. Joe wants to know about Castro's wealth. He recalls a Forbes News report that characterized the personal wealth as astronomical. I think Forbes said it was estimated at nearly $1 billion.
That has not been proven. I don't think so. I don't think that Fidel has that wealth. You know, when you usually call dictators and talk about dictators, you talk about houses in France and houses here and there and wealth. That was not proven. Forbes couldn't come up with real proof that that was the fact.
Well, maybe he can sue Forbes. You know, there's a Saudi prince who's now suing Forbes because he underestimated his wealth.
Well, I don't think Fidel is doing that, but he was very incensed with that. I mean, the man lives like a former president. I mean, but that he has this wealth, I don't believe it.
We thank you for being with us. Pleasure to have had you here.
Thank you for being here, and it was a pleasure to talk with you and with everyone who called.
Carlos Alzogaray, again, is a former Cuban ambassador to the European Union and served 35 years in the Cuban Foreign Service. He's also contributing editor now of Temas, a Cuban social science journal, and he'll be at the Commonwealth Club this afternoon at tomorrow at noon.
This afternoon I will be at the Center for Latin American Studies at Stanford University.
Well, muchas gracias otra vez. Mucho gusto conocerle.
Por nada.
And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. And we want to mention that Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.